SQL Down Under is a podcast for professionals working in the SQL Server community. SQL Server is a trademark of Microsoft Corporation. Opinions expressed during the podcast are individual opinions and may not reflect the opinions of SQL Down Under or of Microsoft Corporation.
Introducing Show 94 with guest Ben Weissman. Our guest today is fellow data platform MVP, Ben Weissman. Ben focuses on data warehousing and analytics, still with a lot of on-premises work, but of course also Fabric and Azure work. He has long experience with SQL Server, having started back in SQL Server 6.5. Ben says he loves to travel and loves food. He's the author of books and video courses and the organizer of data-related events I've noticed across Europe. So Ben also has a podcast called Finding Data Friends. So welcome, Ben.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Great to be on the show.
So look, what I'll get you to do maybe first up, Ben, is just tell people who you are and what part of the world you're mostly in and what sort of work you're currently doing.
So I'm based out of Nuremberg, Germany, and these days this is also where I mostly am, unless I'm traveling for either vacation or events, much less business travel than in the pre-COVID days, which is not necessarily to be missed.
Yeah.
As you've already pointed out, my main day job is data warehousing and analytics. We're still doing a fair share of on-prem work. I'm even going to say at this point we're still at a majority on-prem. We try to be where our customer is, and Central Europe has always been notoriously slow at adopting technology change, I'm going to say, finger pointing at everyone around me basically. And that just means we see a vast pickup, and that there is a change that we definitely see, but it just took us, or our customers, for the general market here, forever to move towards the cloud. So that's why we're still doing that, because we feel like we don't want to push our clients where we think or where Microsoft thinks they should be, but where they feel comfortable and where their technology stack and also their skill set actually is able to support them. So that's what we do. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter for us.
With the on-premises work you're doing, what's the percentage as opposed to having machines and VMs on literally on-premises, or any of them just a hybrid arrangement with VMs that are cloud-based, but they still treat the whole thing like it's on-premises?
Very, very few do infrastructure as a service, because there was this very long-standing time. And I feel like we're slightly getting back to that now with data sovereignty and all that.
Yeah.
With recent happenings and discussions. But I'm going to say we have like a small handful of customers, if at all, that actually did infrastructure as a some moved to a data center operated by like a local, not even hyperscaler, but by a local ISP. So they may not actually own the hardware, but those that actually moved into one of the big clouds and just run VMs there rather than running on-prem, very, very few. So for those that are on-prem, it may not be on their actual premises, also for security aspects and all that, but in general, it is actually either their own hardware or something really, really close. Those that move to the cloud, at least for our customers, but that may also be us pushing them, because my point is always, if you're moving to the cloud, do it right. So make sure you actually leverage all these things the cloud can give you, all these different services, all these abstractions of options that you get that you just do not get if you're just doing infrastructure as a service. It's just modern hosting. You may get your VMs spun up a little faster, and you may get a nice discount if you do the reservation, etc. But it's not really modernizing your data estate in the way that it should be.
Yeah, I find a few clients I worked with, we find it more flexible just in terms of things like test equipment or proof of concepts or things like that. I find that a big one. Like I was at a site a while back who does absolutely everything themselves on premises, and we needed to test some always on availability group things. And if I had been able to spin that up in Azure, I could have tested that the next day, you know. But the way they did things, it literally took, I think it was about 3 weeks to get a quote for the hardware they needed.
Yeah.
It then took around 6 weeks for it to arrive. And then the thing that was amazing is once it arrived, they couldn't take an outage on the power in the rack to install it. So it then took another 4 weeks by the time they actually had it available. And I mean, the thing is, yeah, we could have just spun it up and done the work and shut it all down again the next day. I mean, so yeah, things like that drive me insane, you know, where they're sort of short-term projects that could be just spun up on demand. But yeah, the longer-term ones, that's a different story.
Agreed.
Mm. And so look, what we wanted to talk about today, I wanted to talk about some things in SQL Server 2025, which is finally sort of out the door. And in particular, the ones that have raised some interest there, I wanted to talk about the vector data type, probably the REST-based interfaces there, and they do list it as an AI product. Everything has AI branding on it nowadays. And so maybe if we just start with the vector data type. And so from maybe if you start with what has been provided in terms of vector data types.
So basically SQL 25 comes with two new data types, JSON and vector. That's the two new thingies that we get. And for anything AI or semantic search related, vector is the type to go. Let's maybe take a step back. And for those that don't even know what a vector actually is, I'm pretty sure everybody learned about, oh, this is how you do vector calculations when they went to school and everything. But this is a bit more complex than that.
That won't relate them to a database necessarily. Yeah.
That won't relate them to a database. And also the vectors, at least that I work with in school, had like three, maybe four dimensions. Mm. In the data world, we're talking 678,024 up to like 3,000 different dimensions. Yeah. Basically, a vector is a numerical representation of something else. And I'm going to put that generically blunt there for a reason. It can be an image. It can be a text. It can, in theory, be a number, though I haven't seen the great use case to use it for numbers, to be quite honest. Mm. But let's say you have a paragraph that is talking about a cat, and you have a paragraph that is talking about a dog, and you have a paragraph that is talking about a house. You could take these three paragraphs and transform them into a vector, which means you're transforming them into numbers. And if you, for example, have 768 dimensions, that means you're going to have that into 768 different numbers somewhere on a multidimensional field. Well, field isn't even right because a field's a two-dimensional thing, but it's also not a sphere. I have no idea what it is. It's some kind of coordinate system. And by putting those into numbers, you can then compare these numbers, which is much easier than comparing text to each other, because in text, you could just be, if you basically have three times the same text and the only difference is the words dog, cat, and mouse, then sure. But this is not the case that we find in books, in literature, in whatever. So by turning that into numbers, you can now take these different vectors. You can now take these numbers and compare their distance to each other, which is a mathematically operation which is way above my head, but I don't need to understand the math because SQL Server is doing all that quite nicely for me. And basically, by comparing them, you can then figure out how similar they are. So you have a paragraph talking about a cat, you have one talking about a dog, you have one talking about a house. The cat and the dog will have most probably closer numbers to each other than the one with the house, because two are talking about, it's two different animals, quite literally, but it's still two animals, whereas one is talking about something entirely different. And to turn something from text or an image or a document into a vector, you will need an AI model to do that. So there's tons of models out there. Some are very generic and some are very specialized. So there's some that are specializing in finance, some that are specializing in healthcare. So as all the models out there, and I'm sure everybody has at least used Copilot or ChatGPT at least once to give it a try. I use it on a daily basis, to be quite honest, yes, because it makes a lot of my life.
I probably couldn't work without them now. Yep.
That was fast.
Speed that I can work. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, it's also supporting my laziness, or as I sometimes mm-hmm. like to call it, efficiency, but it is laziness. Something as simple as writing a pivot or unpivot. Of course, I could do that. And of course, if I think really hard, I will come up with a syntax for it. Or I'm just like, hey, ChatGPT, I got these four columns and need those to be pivoted or unpivoted in T-SQL. And half a second later, there's my statement. It just makes my life so much easier and faster.
I find I use it to double check things, you know, where almost like I would a pair programming thing, except it's I'm using it rather than some other person. Like I was doing some coding just before and I got it to look at a function and there was one branch where I had used the wrong variable or whatever. And yeah, it just picked it up yep. straight away. And that's something that could have been painful to find over time.
Indeed. So back to our vectors. You're using a similar model as you would use to talk to ChatGPT. The big difference is a vector is something stable. So if you're using the same model, the word cat will always result in the same numbers. If you're asking the same question three times to ChatGPT, you may get three times the correct answer. It will be three times slightly different worded, unless you're super specific. If you're like, only give me the number and then you give it like a mathematical operation, yes, then the answer will be exactly the same, most probably three times. But in this case, it is stably always the same thing. Mm. So what you would basically do is, okay, there's a new record in my table. I'm going to send that to my AI, get the vector back and save it in that new vector data type. And the fact that I can store it in that new data type, because I could have taken that content before and just saved it in like an NVAR charmux, for example. Hmm. That would have been, but that wouldn't have allowed me to do all the subsequent operations when I'm actually trying to query.
Or even with the numbers, you could have stored them as a JSON array, but that would limit the number of things you could do. But it also introduces the term embeddings, I suppose we should throw in at this point as well.
I mean, embeddings, vectors, that's basically, it's almost like a synonym. And if somebody that really knows their stuff, they would probably be like, no, it is not. But from my point, it is. I'm pretty sure there's some detailed differences in between. And by turning that into numbers and by making sure they're always, we're not making sure it's always the same, but since the fact is just that it's always the same, that means I could now ask a question, turn that into a number as well, turn that into a vector and calculate the distance. So now you can do something directly in your database. And I think that is the actual interesting and the smart part.
Could be comparing data in the database, the different embedding or vector values from each of those, or we could be taking a query from a person and using that to look it up as well.
Your query could now be, show me a not so expensive bike. Rather than select stuff from products where price equals cheap and product type equals bike.
But I think importantly, because it's got an AI model there, then it also understands the language dramatically better than anything else you'd do where you're just trying to do full text comparisons or things like that.
Exactly. It even understands languages, plural. I could ask it something in German and it would still find products with an English description potentially. Again, kind of depending on the model, because if I'm using a model that doesn't understand German, that wouldn't get me anywhere. So picking the right model for your use case is key.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that people should put the most time in there, because all the rest is solved. Also, I'm going to say, nothing of what we're getting here hasn't existed before, but the fact that it's moving right into the engine, that we could do that right in the database, it's making stuff so much simpler, so much easier. We're taking out so many potential braking and friction points out there. That is the huge game changer to me.
I suppose that's an interesting question right there straight away that you'll get from a number of DBRs and say, does this have any place in the database in the first place?
My honest answer would be yes, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Vector databases have been around for quite a while. So databases that basically specialize in just that. What we're seeing now is something that is coming from a specialized database and moving into the core SQL engine. So if you want to do that kind of semantic search that we just talked about, looking for not so expensive bike, you could have taken those texts, could have turned them into vectors and stored them in a specialized vector database before. That would have just meant you're running an extra component, you're running an extra service, you're running an extra database, you're running an extra either ETL or virtualization or whatever, because that data kind of needs to move over. You may also have just gone through your SQL table and then have some kind of middleware or whatever. It's about simplifying stuff. Things are moving closer to the engine, and that is where I see it, because if you care about semantic search and AI with your data, and as you've pointed out, these days everything has got the AI label, and we're not going to get away from that anytime soon.
This is not the level of investment that's.
I was going to say this is too big to fail. This is not where people are like, well, nobody wants to buy our MP3 player. We're going to end this. That was a different story. This isn't going anywhere. So the question is, either is it something that you're going to ignore for the time being, and depending on which kind of business you are in, you may take longer time to do that than others. Also, in all honesty, not everything has an AI use case. I have so many discussions with customers these days. They're like, oh, we need to use AI. And I'm like, cool. Why? Because everybody does. I'm like, okay.
Because everybody does, yeah.
But what is, and I see tons of, don't get me wrong, I'm not the old man shouting at the cloud. There is so much good summarizing a Teams meeting. Just have Copilot do that. Amazing. So many other things.
You know, the ChatGPT that we talked about surprised me most, coming from a database or computing background, when dealing with, say, tools like ChatGPT or things like that, is just the way that I find all the time, if I have, say, 10 things to do, and I'll say, look, reformat these 10 things for me, it'll do the first 6 or 7 correct, and then the 7th or 8th one, it'll just do something different, and then it'll do something different again on the 9th. And I sort of look and I think, you know, that's just such a different experience to anything I've sort of done in computing before, where normally once something gets it right, it just keeps doing it right from that point on. But it's like every single thing that it generates, it's not that it hasn't done anything like it before, but it's like it's reassessing what it needs to do as you go along. And yeah, that sort of felt strange to me. And so even if you put a query in place, how it would interpret that, yeah, I could imagine that being different on at different stages. So
I agree. I mean, that's the good news, I guess. All these examples show us that it's not going to take our jobs anytime soon, but it's going to make our jobs easier if we let it, and if we use it right. And if we which means asking the right questions, using the right models, using it in an ethical and also responsible way. So uploading all your employees' personal data to ChatGPT just to get that nicely formatted, maybe not the best of ideas, et cetera. But it is definitely here to help.
I've found one of the things that I learned recently with prompts is to be very specific with the engines, to tell them thing, like, I think they're designed to be overly positive, and they tend to sort of gaslight you a bit and things. And I think they're designed to be very encouraging and so on and whatever. And that leads them to do things that they just shouldn't do, you know. And so I do find I have a discussion with some of these tools all the time where I'm saying, look, don't be overly enthusiastic, you know, just be matter of fact. And if you don't know something, just tell me. Don't go and guess and things like that. And so, like, I tend to get a big list of these things, which is part of the context, going, this is how I want you to process this stuff. Because, yeah, before I started doing that sort of thing, again, I would just have endless arguments with some of these tools, you know, where, you know, I would ask it to do something, you know, like go to this website, grab a table off here, and then reformat it for me as YAML, you know? And it'll go, yeah, sure. And And then I would look at the output, and the first three or four rows were right, but the rest, it had just hallucinated the things, and they're not things that were on the site at all, you know. And so then I'd have this discussion saying, you didn't read that from the site. You need to read the actual data. And I remember one of them, I had an argument with it for about a half an hour, at which point it finally told me that it didn't have the ability to go out and read it, even though it had just spent the last 20 minutes insisting that it had.
What a time to be alive. You're arguing with a machine for 30 minutes.
That sort of thing. It's going to be interesting having that sort of logic coming into systems. But nonetheless, it is insanely powerful. And so if we have the data that we go off and create vectors from, and we store them in the database, then having a vector that we can use for a query, now that could be done in the database, or it could be done separately by the application before it sent the query into the database as well. But then we have the ability to compare those, and we've got a number of functions there, and the main one being vector distance, right? So
correct.
Tell us about vector distance.
So basically, you got two things. You got vector distance and vector search. Let's just cover them at once. Yeah. Because
is search what you see as the primary use case?
No. And that is because of the current limitation. So vector distance will basically do a row-by-row compare. It is doing an exact nearest neighbor. It will compare every single row, whereas search is doing an estimate nearest neighbor. So it's using something called a vector index, and which is nothing like a B-tree index or anything. It's a graph table, basically, that will just simplify things a lot. If you're looking at a lot of data, I did a thing in my lab using the Stack Overflow database, querying just the thread starters, so like 25 million rows, 25-ish million rows, using a vector index, 0.1 seconds. Yeah. Not using the vector index, half a minute, roundabout. Yep. So huge difference. However, a vector index makes your table read-only. So it just takes a lot more work when it comes to table design, when it comes to index design, when it comes to layouts, when it comes to planning your maintenance windows, because they're also not online updatable or anything. So it really means dropping and recreating the index, depending on how big your table is. Creating that index may take, and of course, there's ways around that. You do a temp table that you insert everything into, calculate the index on that, then you swap them out. There's ways around it, but unless you really have
to. Yeah, any of those ones where you've got a read-only big chunk. I mean, I remember with the early days of column store indexes, for example, is similar thing. We would have a big read-only chunk, and then we would have a little read-write bit, and then we would make a union over them or something like that. But, yeah, you had to do some work to get around something that's read-only,
And I do not have any timelines or anything that I can or cannot share, but I think column store indexes are the perfect example. We started off the very same way, so this is something that at some point, I don't know when that point may be. Is it happening in the next SQL Server version? Is it happening? I don't know. But at some point, this restriction will go away, which is when I will see people dramatically switching over to vector search, obviously, because it is so much faster. It is so much more efficient. Also, it takes basically zero IO. I mean, not zero, but compared to what basically a table scan across millions and millions of rows. Yeah. It also depends on the use case, of course. When I'm demoing this at conferences, what I will usually do is I will just take the session abstracts for that specific conference. Mm-hmm. So even for a big conference, we're talking about 150 rows tops.
Yeah.
No problem here. Table scanning 150 rows.
That's right. Table
SQL scanning Server has got this. Yeah. And then one of my questions is usually, does anybody in the room have a table that has more than 150 rows? Because this is obviously where it's getting interesting. So it's also not, never use vector distance, because for some use cases, I would just stick to it, because why would I even care about maintaining an index if I don't have to?
Mm-hmm.
for small tables, et cetera, et cetera. So it kind of depends. And because again,
also, well, there is a vector distance function. So one thing I suppose we should mention there as well is that there are different distance metrics that correct. You can use. So it's not just one function. It's
that is correct.
Cosine, however, Euclidean dot, you know, and so on. So there's different ways of doing that. Yeah.
We get the three mentioned. And if you look at like the literature, they're going to be like, oh, use this one for documents, use this one for text, use this one for numbers. So maybe I'm just doing things wrong. I tested a lot on that. My results are always almost the same. Like if I look at like the top three, the closest results, in most cases, they're either identical. Sometimes one and two are swapped. The numbers are obviously different just because one gets negative, one doesn't. One is capped between zero and one. So they will use different ranges for the distances. In the end, it's still about what is closest, so who gets the lowest distance. And so just looking at who the actual winners are, my results are always the same. So, and I'm pretty sure your mileage may vary on that if you're getting into something super specific, like somebody using a highly trained model for physics and some very specialized doc, their mileage may potentially vary vastly on that. If you're getting started with this, and let's face it, most of the people not just listening to this show, but actually starting to work with vectors are super new to this. Don't overthink if you're using Euclidean dot or cosine. I just go with cosine by default because it's kind of the first one in that
it's
row.
It's the one I see in most applications,
And honestly, my guess would be because alphabetically it's the first, because again, from the result, I do not see any at least noticeable differences in there. Like even going over bigger databases or bigger amounts of data, I did not see anything was like, oh wow, that changed everything. It's still finding basically the same results.
Listen, next thing I think we should mention is probably about the actual data type as well. I know for quite a while there, the SQL Server team was hesitant to add new data types, right? And largely because it's not just the case of adding a data type to the database, then engine, then you've got to worry about all the clients, the client libraries, and so on and so on and so on. It's just, it's a lot of work, you know, once they start doing that. But this time round, they decided, as we mentioned, they did a JSON data type. So where before we had all the functions like is it JSON and, you know, JSON paths and all these different things, but we didn't have an actual JSON data type. So we finally got that in place, but then they added the vector data type. If I look at the way it's done, I've used it in Postgres as well. And they have an extension. So there's PG vector that you can add to your database. And effectively what you're storing when you store it, they do have a vector data type. And when you store it, it's just like a big array of numbers. But one of the key differences is that if you need to store large numbers of them, then they're happy to break out of the page and go to using their Toast extension, so going to bigger things. But one of the things in the SQL Server one at the moment, we're still limited to a fairly tight number of numbers in the vector, so in terms of the number of dimensions. Has that been an issue in anything you've done as yet? Or
no. So first of all, the numbers in the vector, or how many dimensions you store in your vector, that will depend on your model. It's not like I want to store more information, so I'm going from 768 to 1024. No, your model will come back with a certain number of dimensions.
Yeah, I think what I'm sort of getting at is there's a whole lot of models now that are 16,000, 32,000, things like they are. There's some fairly big numbers there. But the other thing to keep in mind is it's all right to be able to have that, but you've got to store that. And if that's for every row in a table or something, that can be a lot of data.
And the question is also, how much more precision is it actually giving me? Yeah. So the SQL Server limit right now is 3,000-something-something. Mm-hmm. I would have to look up the exact number. I think it's 3,096, but I may be off by a few there. But it's somewhere in the low 3,000s, which is a lot. most of the, I'm going to say, consumer models, they're at like 768,024, yeah, somewhere in that range. So that still leaves a huge gap. Even when I looked at some specialized ones, I was getting into the low 2000s. The models that I've been looking at for stuff that I tried to solve, I never got beyond those 3,000. So my assumption would be, this is also what Microsoft, when they came up with this, that they were like, well, these were the models that we experienced with, and none of them were bigger than X. Let's add this and this much. Because it gets way more complex in storing that without necessarily adding tons of more use cases.
Yeah.
If you're using something that has 16,000 dimensions or more, and I'm not arguing if these things exist, they definitely do. Mm. But if that is something you're using, you probably have such specific requests and such specific use cases that I'm going to argue you probably want to look into something that really specializes in this anyway, because, I mean, that has always been the case. SQL Server does so many things these days, and it can do so much. But there's always other tools on the side that you may use and that you may prefer if it just does not cover all your bases. So yeah, I'm going to say this will work for in the vector space, probably going to work for like 98% of people. And then you have these super specific scientific approaches that, in all honesty, probably wouldn't consider SQL Server as their data store for that anyway. Because that's the other thing. A little sidetrack here. We got SQL databases in Fabric now, which in theory you could be like, well, let's use that for all our apps going forward because it is so easy to deploy. Would the typical Python developer consider a SQL database in Microsoft Fabric as their data backend? I'm not super convinced by that, to be quite honest. let's leave it at that. So, this is kind of my point.
I think the other thing is that underneath at the moment, it was still effectively an array of float 32 values. I noticed there's a preview of being able to store them as float 16 as well.
Correct.
And that would have a big impact on the memory consumption that you're using as well.
You're basically cutting it in half. So the default is still float 32, which is in line with most other vector databases out there.
Yep.
As you've pointed out, they brought in float 16, and it is currently a preview feature. I had to guess, I think it's only a preview feature because it came in so late and they were like, okay, we're not taking a chance here.
Hi, this is Greg. Just wanted to thank you for listening to this show and let you know that if you'd like to let me teach you more about SQL Server, we now have both free courses and low-cost courses available online and on demand. The courses include detailed hands-on lab work for you to complete to reinforce your learning, and there are more courses coming in the next few months. You'll find details at training.sqldownunder.com.
I have not had any issues with that. It's basically cutting your storage in half. Mm. And again, for the data that I was looking at, again, exact same results. So while you could argue, well, it's only half as precise, and that is true, it's still precise enough. So again, if I have a table of 150 rows, I don't care. I'm going to go with float 32 because it's the default. Why would it matter to me if I'm storing? However, if you're talking about millions of rows, you're bringing down I/O a lot. You bring down storage a lot. You bring down memory. You reduce all your system usage basically by half to anything related around that vector. So that definitely makes sense to look into. Make sure to double check.
Calling the model and calculating the vector embedding values. So again, we say it could be done by an application before it inserts the data into SQL Server, but it could also be SQL Server that reaches out to the model and does this and gets back the values. One of the things that I wish we did have in SQL Server was a better way to call things asynchronously inside the database. Like, I'd love to be able to fire off a thing and say, go and get this, and then, you know, just return it when you come back, you know, where previously, the only way we've done asynchronous triggers was to use Service Broker or something like that, which is another whole layer of entertainment. I just wish I could actually say something like exec async and then give something a name and it would go and do it. But to make that call out of there, we've had the ability now to call REST-based services, which these are REST-based services. So tell us about calling those.
So that change to me is even bigger, or that feature to me is even bigger than the AI thingy, because everybody these days has some kind of boxes, services, or whatever that uses REST APIs.
Yep.
I don't have a single client anymore that is like, no, we don't have that. We don't use that. Depending on where you are, you may have your on-prem storage array that has a REST API. You may be calling the Azure Management API to get some inventory or some stats or to create a snapshot. You may be querying data from a REST API. But REST APIs, that's huge. And the nice... people may have used that in the Azure flavor of SQL before, because calling REST APIs has been a thing there for about, I'm going to say, 2 years at this point.
Yeah, I'd say a couple of years.
However, there's a huge limitation in the Azure flavor, which is you can only call certain endpoints. So whenever you wanted to call something that is not in a certain whitelist of domains, you basically had to write or create a proxy, which wasn't the end of the world, but it still added that extra level of complexity. Whereas in SQL 25, you can call any REST API as long as it talks SSL. That's the only requirement.
I think, again, they were just a bit cautious. I remember when they were first introducing that, they had their list of things and they were saying, hey, is there something else you want to call all the time that isn't in this list? And they were listening to what we wanted to call. But yeah, to me, the ability to call is just a generic thing. It's one of the other things that I find that they tend to do is they tend to wrap the services up to too high a degree for me. So I'll give an example. There's the change event streaming nowadays, and they've given us the ability to call using the change event streaming, but to do that, they have to call Event Grid or things like that. And see, to me, I would have rather they exposed the make it easy to call Event Grid and then built change event streaming over the top of that. But they tend to sort of bundle them up. And then, I often want those intermediate things to be, because I look at nowadays to be a good Azure citizen, they need to play managed identity properly, because again we've got to call as somebody, and so that's got to be a better story now in 2025. But the credentials to me are a really big issue in amongst that sort of thing, and so what have you been doing when you're in terms of credentials when you're calling these services?
So first of all, with SQL 25 you do get managed identity, which is amazing. You have to ARC enable your box, but that's
it's not the end of the
friction.
World. Yeah, that's right.
And honestly, if you want this to be an Azure managed I think this is not one of these things where they're like, oh, you have to do this, which has nothing to do with it, but we just want you to use our product. No, you want it to get an Azure. Of course, it needs to talk to Azure to have an Azure identity. Yeah. I mean, that makes perfect sense. Other than that, my answer would honestly be it depends, because all REST APIs are different. I got some REST APIs that don't use credentials at all because they just give me back something like exchange rates, where they're like, cool, here you go. I got REST APIs that limit based on IP addresses rather than credentials.
Yes.
Also, no credentials to be used. Otherwise, you can use...
Those.
Yep. You can use API keys in a query string or post them. You can use OAuth, which is you got like a tiny hoop to jump through. You basically create your token using I usually use a stored proc, and then create a dynamic credential out of that. But either way, you can do that.
The one that everybody always seems to want is they want service principles, but I prefer managed identities, because again they don't expire, where if you set up a service principle, yes, it's independent, but I do worry about all these places where people have configured them
exactly.
And just one day there's this random time bomb that's going to go off where they just expire.
I also feel like that service principles are kind of, well, we've always done it, I mean always in air quotes, because it's it's not been that long that we've been using Azure, if you look at the grand scale of things. But I feel like this is where lots of, well, this is just kind of what I'm used to. I'm like, yeah, but like you said, a managed identity comes with a handful of, also when it comes to govern them, et cetera, it's so much easier, no matter if you're using Purview or whatever kind of animal you're using to kind of herd your cats. I'm team managed identity wherever I can use that. But again, you can use basically anything. It can be a username and password, which you could then store encrypted in your database.
As a credential. Correct. Usually, yeah. Or again, be nice. I would like to see it be easier to use Key Vault inside SQL Server. Because again, that's the logical place for those things.
No, agreed. And from a security perspective, given all the integration that we have now, I would say that's probably the biggest gap. Then again, we're kind of at V1 for REST APIs, so I would assume that is something. They probably need to see some adoption first and see what people are actually using it for before deciding on. Because the answer might also be, and we're going to get to that with the AI models in a sec, because the AI models, they're being facilitated by the REST API as well, because talking to your AI model, that happens through the REST API of a model. And what I'm seeing for on-prem customers, which is what SQL 25 customers are, or let's call them self-managed customers if you want. I mean, we had that discussion at the very beginning of the show. I very rarely see people running like their full-grown SQL servers in VM. I know there's people doing, I know there's a lot of people doing. I mean, otherwise there wouldn't be a dedicated product for it. It's not what I'm seeing with my customers. So my customers that are like on-prem, they may have latency reasons for that. They may have security reasons for that. But that also means they may not want to send all their data across the internet the entire time. You can run your AI models on-prem as well, self-managed, which is what I'm doing. So I'm running Ollama. There's other tools as well. Ollama is the one that I'm seeing most widely used. Going to have some resources for you at the end of the show for those that want to try to get started with that. But
it's certainly the one that I most commonly see where people have run it on premises themselves. Yeah.
Which means so the result might also be most people might be like, oh, I don't want to use Key Vault because I want to have something on prem, and then Microsoft would need to think like, so.
So let's talk about models then, because that's the other topic. Which are the ones you think are most important for people doing SQL Server work to have a look at?
So, most important is a big word. I just use basically the most popular.
Which ones have you been using or trying?
So the one I'm mostly using to chat with my data is called Mistral, which is one of the, I'm going to say, medium-sized models. I got a couple of others, but that's the one I'm mostly using because it seems to be the one of those that finds a very good fit between not being too big, so it fits on my GPU, not being too small, so it can actually answer most of the questions that I have.
So it is one that you're running locally in your case?
Yes.
Yeah.
Correct. Okay. So all my models are running locally for... I mean, for just the models, what I could do is I could run then like an Azure OpenAI or something like that, for example. But for me, the whole point of that exercise is actually, since I'm running SQL 25 on-prem, to have everything on-prem. So I built myself a tiny little lab there that basically gets that job done for me. Having that said, I've looked, again, besides very specific use cases like healthcare, finance, real estate, etc. Mistral will probably go to my go-to model to get started with. There's another one that I'm using for vectors called MXBAI or MXBay or whatever they pronounce themselves. However, my loading a model takes like 2 minutes. It needs to get downloaded and be used by Ollama. So my suggestion would be if you're downloading Ollama and if you're using Ollama, just take a look. They have like 150 something models, I think, at this point, that all come with a very distinct description also on how they have been trained and what they can do. Mistral is one of the ones.
One question. It's in relation to machine learning models, actually. I don't know if you were using those in the past or whether you think there's still a specific role for those in the database as opposed to just the things that we have with the AI models that we're looking at here.
I think they still have their place, but it's a different use case. So I'm not a machine learning expert.
Yeah.
But what I'm seeing with clients using that in the database, they would still more like use something like ML services, or the built-in Python or R integration. And again, I don't think I have a single customer using R integration these days.
No, but I suppose the thing you could do with those is you can sort of like compile a model and like Onyx models and these different types. But the main thing is I see them used, you can use them for prediction. So like it's a lot of work to compile the model, but then the model, you can load it up and just do really, really fast predictions, you know, on large numbers of rows. And so I don't think that's terribly impacted by the availability of these other types of models. I think there's still a use case there for that. But it's just another style of model that you could be involved with. What about anything in, did you find anything hard troubleshooting-wise? Or I'm thinking the other things for the DBAs, really monitoring and how do you know what impact the working with the models is having on your system, you know, and things like that. So
from a troubleshooting perspective, I found it fairly straightforward because the requirements are fairly easy. Like I said, all you need is an SSL endpoint.
Yep.
So like the only issues I ran into was, well, Ollama isn't running.
Mm-hmm.
This is an HTTP monitoring thingy. Everybody running there, that's easy. That problem has been solved a couple of decades ago.
And we should add that if you're in an Azure-related environment, there's all sorts of built-in stuff you can use to monitor that.
Also that. Is the SSL certificate valid? That's the only other. Can I talk to the endpoint, and does it have a proper valid SSL certificate? That's basically the only two things that you need to test against. Both of these issues have been in Azure and on-prem solved, like I said, decades ago.
Mm.
If you got the and if they're actually reachable, but this is kind of the, like from that box, which is kind of the
anything you suggest people should be monitoring?
I would
specifically
definitely monitor the SSL endpoint of the model.
Mm-hmm.
Just from an availability perspective. Ideally, obviously from the at least the same subnet as your SQL box is in, because otherwise there may still be routing issues, etc. What I tend to do, first of all, you will always need a reverse proxy at this point because Ollama doesn't do SSL. Since you're having a reverse proxy, which could be IIS, which could be Nginx, which could be all sorts of things, I tend to use Nginx because I've always done it this way.
But then there's a layer of things that you've got to look after there as well. Yeah.
But also that means I have basically a built-in load balancer. So my friend Anthony, he actually built a super nice lab because he has access to resources that I don't. We actually built some super nice load balancing, which also means you can scale that solution without changing anything in your code by basically saying, well, we need more GPU power. That GPU is at 100%. We're just going to add another GPU with another Ollama and have Nginx do the load balancing for us. So all your stored procs in SQL will still be exact same thing, which I think is...
That's awesome, Ben. That's pretty much bringing us up to time. But what's happening in your world? Where will people see you or hear from you or anything else coming up?
So I will be at SQL Conference in Germany.
Wonderful.
At the beginning of March, which will be March
2nd. And that's conference with a K, that one, isn't it?
With a K, exactly. Yes. So it's SQL Conference, which is... I mean, we've had that debate so many times. Shall we rebrand this thing? Because, of course, it's not all SQL these days. We talk about Databricks. We talk about...
Yeah, that's right. That. Most of the SQL things have been rebranded as data something. Yeah.
Also, is conference with a K, which is the German word for conference.
Yeah, I think given that's...
That most of our sessions are in English.
Nice little slant. Yeah, I quite like having a K on that. Yeah.
That thing has been around for quite a while. We had our 20-year anniversary, I'm going to say, 2 years ago. So
as soon as I see the K, it immediately positions it in a specific area of Europe. Yeah.
So there we are. We got Data Grillen happening in May, also in Germany. Mm-hmm. We got our German Data Saturday. I will most certainly be in Barcelona for the European FabCon, just because I will not be coming to Atlanta, because yeah. Barcelona is so much closer. Also Barcelona, yes. At the end of September is, that's going to be nice. Mm. And probably a couple of other events or user groups here and there, but those will be events. So if anybody happens to be on my side of the world there, please come and say hello.
Awesome. Well, listen, thank you so very much for your time today, Ben.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me again.
Awesome. Thanks.